Welcome to Open Comments with myself, Ash.
And me, Oliver.
Where we'll discuss things openly with our guests from a variety of backgrounds and from different walks of life. Through this podcast, we hope to give you an inside look into a variety of topics with an equal mix of humour and candour. In this series, we'll touch on some of the following topics: healthcare, HR, diversity, access to technology, and lots more. We hope you enjoy our show and look forward to bringing more topics into the fold. Let's get started.
Okay, welcome everyone. And today we have a special guest. We have Dr. Jason Lee. Jason Lee is a healthcare and science and federal health policy expert with many years of public and private sector experience, a respected facilitator, collaborator, and speaker, and he's currently the director of the Open Group Healthcare Forum. So Jason, could you please maybe introduce yourself and maybe talk a little bit about the Healthcare Forum and what you do?
You bet. Thank you, gentlemen. I appreciate the opportunity to talk to you today. So introduce myself. I am I'm a health policy guy who found his way to the Open Group and have been working for 8+ years now, trying to figure out how this thing called enterprise architecture can help with so many of the problems that face the healthcare system today across the world. The Healthcare Forum started with a really basic question that essentially remains, and that is captured in the byline of the Open Group, which is boundaryless information flow. Now, the boundaryless part sometimes raises people's antenna because they don't really want information to be boundaryless. We want their information to be secure and safe. So, of course, that today virtually goes without saying. But the flow of information is so critical. It's in healthcare called interoperability. And the word interoperability means different things in different industries. But in healthcare, this idea that information collected in one place ought to be available for the patient's benefit when they go to another place, whether it's down the hall in a hospital setting or from one provider to another, or when they're traveling, information should be readily available and understandable, and it's not. There are a lot of reasons for that. That's been the core issue we've focused on from the beginning. Through the years, it's remained key. Today, we're working specifically on the development of a reference architecture for the hospital setting, whether the hospital's in an urban center in a metropolitan area, or it's in a rural area, or anywhere in between. There's just thousands of hospitals around the world. So developing a single reference architecture that would be applicable to hospitals generally has been our passion for the last couple of years.
That's great. Now, touching further on digital health, now we're aware that it's very huge right now. So can you explain to us how it really started and what are the current challenges?
Sure. That's a big question, because digital is big everywhere, and healthcare being the major single source of costs in developed countries, it's everywhere in healthcare. It's everywhere in healthcare, and yet it's not in healthcare enough. When did it start? It started when computers started. So from the very beginning of being able to communicate information electronically, it started. And today, years later, as we look toward the movement of healthcare into the fourth industrial revolution, we see all kinds of examples of digital in health. We see it in our life as well, and how to cross that chasm is one of the challenges. So, for example, on my wrist is a smartwatch, and that watch tells me what my blood pressure is when I exercise. It even has an ability to tell me if I have a coronary event. Some watches, some medical devices can test blood glucose. So for people with diabetes, that's quite key. And a watch is just one type of medical device that people wear and take around with them. The question, of course, when people do collect medical information through devices that they either wear or that are part of their clothing increasingly, that's a trend, or that they have at home, is how do you get that information communicated to the setting where providers and clinicians are? So that is a challenge. Telemedicine became huge during the pandemic. It existed before. I was part of a study in Massachusetts in which one of the key hospitals had a telemedicine center and wanted to contract with rural hospitals to provide emergency medical consultations when emergency physicians were not available in those rural hospitals. You're a rural hospital, you don't have that many patients, but when you do have a patient, they need immediate care if they're in a high-risk situation. And that rural hospital may only have one emergency doc on staff. And so being able to call into, have remote access through telemedicine to a full-time 24/7 capability to provide advice to a patient at that rural hospital is quite key. Now, in the pandemic, what we saw is that people were not going, they're not leaving the house, yet they still needed medical care. The problem was that physicians who also were, many were staying home and were not available, the creation of the ability to interact with that physician or some other clinician via Zoom became quite important. One of the barriers to advancing that was regulatory, and it had to do with payment. The payment arrangements in different countries often did not allow physicians or clinicians, non-physician clinicians, to be reimbursed for a phone call. You had to actually go in and visit the clinician in person. So that, I think, telemedicine, we saw a lot more of it during the pandemic, and countries now will and are discussing and working on regulatory changes to enable more telemedicine. Other examples of data of rather of digital in healthcare relates to the whole interoperability issue. In healthcare, every time there's an interaction with a provider, and every time there's some kind of a health event in a person's life, data is generated. And it's really a lot of data. And it's not something typically as simple as something that can be measured like height or weight. It's something that's much more complicated. And so the sheer amount of data that's generated in the healthcare domain is massive. So increasingly the use of computers through artificial intelligence and deep dive analytics is important for simplifying and expediting and reducing the costs and providing more equitable care to populations. The use of the electronic health record is related to some of the things that we've talked about already. Depending where you live and what kind of plan you have, the electronic health record may be more or less available to you. I think everybody is experienced with the frustration of having to fill out the same form again and again and again when they go to different providers. And that's often just basic information like, what's your name? Where do you live? What's your medical history? An electronic health record, though, when it operates in the way that it can operate most beneficially, will contain all the key information that's available about you, so that if you happen to be in a different place, whether it's in your hometown or in another part of the world, people know, what are your allergies? What medicines are you taking? What are your clinical conditions? So that if you require care, that information is available if you're not able to deliver that information directly because of your current health status, or if you don't have family members around you. So an electronic health record is key. And one can go on and on. There are robots that perform surgeries. There are digital twins that are created in hospitals. There's the use of real-time location sensing, which helps hospitals track not just people who have resources and skills that may be needed at different places, but also that track where IT is and where various resources are. And so these are some examples. Others include some of these very, very high-tech imaging devices, the use of augmented reality and virtual reality, so that you can actually put on goggles and see through the human body. I mean, it's not available yet, but where we're headed is the ability to, suppose someone comes in with a wound, and instead of having to comes into the emergency department with a wound, the ability to actually see into the human body and not have to do exploratory work. I mean, this is in the future. This is not science fiction anymore.
That sounds like it would be game changing. Yeah. So I think it's a fair assumption to say that digital health is at least improving accessibility for all to healthcare. And I just want to touch on something. You mentioned the pandemic, and particularly I think we can all say that the pandemic definitely boosted the need for digital health or digital transformation in general. And I just wanted to touch on something You were actually, you and a whole host of collaborators were authors of a guide for max vaccinations. And that was something that was released by the Open Group Healthcare Forum whilst everyone was going through their vaccination campaigns. Now, can you maybe provide a couple of essential pillars that would be needed for a successful vaccination campaign?
Sure. The interesting thing about that paper, which was, by the way, translated into Chinese just a few months after we released it in English, which was, bravo to the Open Group for doing that and getting it out really to the world. The board was prescient. Just sort of saw ahead the need to get on top of this issue, so that when the forum met with the board back in pr prior to the approval of the vaccines, and we had gone to the board and said, well, we'd like to develop an enterprise architecture component that deals with some aspect of the pandemic, because it's right in front of us after all. And so the direction that we received was to, hey, let's, there will be a vaccine. This was back in the fall of 2019, and it was December, it was late December when the UK first approved vaccine, and then in the US in early 2020, the first vaccine was approved. And of course, that's the trigger to start mass vaccination campaign. So the board back in the fall of 2019 had asked us to look into this, and to look into issues like what are the key factors that predict successful mass vaccination campaigns. So kudos to the board for encouraging the healthcare forum to get on top of this, which we did, and then we were able to release within a few months of the first approval of a vaccine, guidance for developing mass vaccination campaigns. Clearly, supply is key. Transport is key, because the vaccine had to be kept within certain parameters of temperature parameters, and the ability to identify where batches are and how long they had been there was also key. You heard stories about how certain number, thousands of vaccine doses were lost, were either lost, or could not be, they were spoiled because they hadn't been kept refrigerated at the right temperature for a period of time. Those abilities to keep the vaccine, to build the supply, to keep the supply chain in order, to which includes transport and cold storage, and then, really critically, the social media and non-social media, the campaigns to educate people on the need to get vaccinated. There were just lots of elements in the paper that we wrote about the need to get out to the people and to communicate in ways that people can hear, and why it is important to get vaccinated. And then the larger need for public health outreach, which extends beyond the pandemic, and really broaches the topic of the need to increase accessibility by practicing population health, thinking about health in terms not just of individuals, but in terms of populations and subpopulations, and how some subpopulations respond to triggers and incentives in different ways than other subpopulations. And that by thinking that way, it's possible to have a healthier population. And by the way, to reduce costs and increase access, which are the big goals of healthcare.
And in your opinion, how do you think we've done? And I say we, I mean globally, nationally, regionally. We're obviously not done with the campaigns yet. It's still something, you know, vaccines are still going on. People are still getting them. How do you think we're doing so far?
With vaccinating people against COVID?
Yeah, with the vaccination campaigns.
Well, I'm not really an expert in this, you know, across the world. The pandemic, some vaccination campaigns have been successful. It's the old, some do, some don't, some will, some won't, some might, some, it's a mixed bag. I mean, some campaigns have been more successful than others. Some places have been more resistant than others. You look at the U.S. and you look at, you know, blue states and red states, which are aligned to the different political parties. And there are some people that are more resistant to getting vaccinated than others. And mass vaccination campaigns have a difficult time reaching some populations more than other populations. And then you have whole countries that have very different approaches. China has a very different approach in terms of lockdown. What we certainly saw is as the pandemic went on and on and on, people got increasingly frustrated with being locked in and shut down. We lost significant amounts of in terms of education of our kids. But people also got the virus more and more and more, and so that the need for mass vaccination campaigns became a little less weighty as more and more people got the vaccine itself. Now, as we get new strains, you know, it's always a catch-up game. It's you know, the COVID is like the flu now, in my opinion, in that we get our influenza vaccine, and we should also get our COVID vaccine. And the people who work in epidemiology and public health use all kinds of digital and non-digital techniques to identify what the strains are and to develop the vaccines for it. And so it's just going to be part of our life now.
Thank you. Yeah, I agree.
Now, to continue all on, so with the rise in digital healthcare, especially post-pandemic, what can healthcare providers do to better provide for their customer base? And what work has already been done? I'm aware this is probably quite a meaty question, so please feel free to break it down.
I think that when you say what can providers do, I really think it's important that we talk about providers in the broadest possible term. So it's not doctors per se. Doctors are working so hard, and not just doctors, nurses, obviously, clinicians, nurse practitioners, aides, allied health professions, psychologists, you name it, social workers. So it's what we can do using digital health to provide better care to people, to citizens, goes so beyond the clinical personnel. The issue goes at the highest level to the regulatory authorities in countries and what kinds of laws they pass to enable access, broad access to some very basic kinds of care. I do think that in the private sector, the commercial models that many of our countries are built on are tremendous in terms of promoting innovation. But I think that the competitive nature of the private sector is such that in digital health, you have a very fragmented system in countries like the US and in actually most countries. But if we take the US as an example, there are multiple electronic healthcare vendors, and what they're able to do, if everyone just plays in their sandbox, is significant. You can exchange data. People know what information means when it's transferred back and forth, but that's because they code it in the same way. But when you then go to a provider that uses a different electronic health record, a different vendor, because the vendors don't collaborate and cooperate because it's not in their financial incentive to do benefit to do so, then the whole thing sort of falls down. And that's just an essential problem that we haven't quite figured out how to deal with in advanced countries like the United States. There's more that can be said about that. So if you want to follow up with a few questions, because that's a big one.
I think, I believe the next question is a follow-on from that. Could you talk a little bit about the Federated Health Information Model, FHIM?
Sure. The FHIM, the Federated Health Information System, is it's a complex system, but it's in its complexity, there's some beauty as well. And it's available at www.fhim.org. It is a product of the Office of the National Coordinator, Office of Federal Health Architecture, which spent almost a dozen years and employed some of the most brilliant information architects in the country to develop a very detailed clinical logical information model. There are, as anyone who goes to that website and digs into it a little bit, it is a highly, highly complex system which promotes the idea of having a way to code information in the same way so that no matter who is receiving care where, the providers that are helping that patient are speaking the same language. It's akin to a Rosetta Stone in healthcare, and that addresses the problem of the fact that there are so many players who are building their own sandboxes and hoping everybody will come into their own sandboxes. I won't name companies, but I think it's fairly obvious who some of these, you know, who some of the companies are. We've got to open up the playground, as it were, and invite people to come in and use a model like the FHIM and advance it. Develop APIs that build off of it, but ultimately settle on a standard way to communicate health information so that not having information about your patient is not a barrier to providing good care. I can give you one example of this if you'd like. I recently had the experience of being with a very close family member who was in hospice care. Hospice is not unique to the US, it's fairly common. in other industrialized countries. And it's a very humane approach to dealing with end-of-life care. So if a physician, or perhaps two physicians, agree that a patient has 6 or fewer months to live, then they become eligible for hospice care, which is essentially it's a palliative form of care. It's not treating a condition, it's helping the patient to pass out of this life in the most humane and comfortable way, with as little pain as possible, to keep family close. And it's not practiced very well, hardly anywhere. I've talked to colleagues in Canada and in the Netherlands and in the UK about this, and it's equally true there. The concrete example I would give is that in this particular family member's situation, they received nursing care at a nursing home. So you have to, a person has to be somewhere, obviously. If they're in a hospital and they get a an end-of-life diagnosis, and they don't choose to have, or they're not approved to have, additional surgeries and, you know, be stuck and poke and all those sorts of things, imaged and all that, and they decide, okay, it's, you know, I've had enough, I just don't want to be treated anymore. Then they either go home, if there is a home, or they go into a nursing home. And in this case, the patient went into a nursing home, and so they received nursing care in that home, and their information was put into the electronic health record at that nursing home. They also received hospice care by a set of, by a physician, a couple of nurses, nurse practitioner, a nurse's aide, and a clergy person, and a social worker. So there was a whole team, and they were on the sideline. They kind of considered themselves sideline coaches. So they were coordinating with the nursing home staff, and the company that provided the hospice care was owned by the nursing home. And yet, the electronic health record that the nursing home used was off limits to the hospice staff. So, same company, different electronic health records. When the hospice nurse came in to check on this person, they didn't go to a computer terminal and look up the digitized data. They went to try to find the nurse that had last treated, or the nurse's aide who had last been in this person's room. Could they find that person? Who knows? Because, you know, there's dozens of people at a nursing home. And so maybe they would find the person and maybe they wouldn't. So it's in this sense that healthcare really needs to take several steps back and fix some of these basic problems of digital health before it can truly advance into the future.
Yeah, there sounds like there's certainly some ways that we could streamline healthcare and providing healthcare. And we've spoken a lot about healthcare providing, but self-healthcare is also something that we all do and all should do, at least. Just a light one here for you is, how do you generally stay healthy?
Love the question. I wish I would do, don't we all wish we would do more of what we know we should do? I think number one, it's close for me. No, there's one and there's two. One is I try to eat well and maintain my weight. I'm reminded of numerous studies that have been done on insects and other animals, ethical studies in which it's known that a low body weight promotes extended life. And so I'm not a doctor, I'm not a physician, and I'm not advising anything through this podcast. I'm saying that for me, eating healthy foods and staying away from unhealthy foods is the best way to control weight. And based on the data I've seen, more than a majority of the cause of weight is based on diet. And of course, the comparison there is exercise. Exercise is important and is key. And before I described how important swimming is in my life, swimming, weight bearing exercises as well. I think if you're just in the water, that may not be sufficient. So mixing it up is important. I firmly believe in the idea that motion is lotion. So staying active, the muscles definitely, just as the brain, I believe, follows the use it or lose it principle. I wrote a dissertation and a book a long time ago focused on abstraction and aging. And the finding there, and this is prehistory almost, is that the more one uses their brain as they age, the more that activity promotes higher level thinking as defined by abstraction. And lo and behold, that's been borne out by more and more studies. So just as with cognition, with physical health, and of course there's psychological well-being and mental health and all kinds of, there's aspects of brain wellness as well as physical wellness. Use it or lose it is a really key principle. And that's one I try to live by.
Thank you. That's really great as well. Just, we really appreciate you sharing your hobbies, and especially with something like swimming. I feel like many of our listeners can agree on this, is that even not only just swimming, but just, taking up a sport, it can be very cathartic and it can really help you with, day to day, but also also giving you that outlet of, that something that is your thing per se. And it just helps, I guess, just release that stress and excess energy. And it's just nice to have something which you can do at your own pace. It's not rushed. Everyone has different athletic abilities. You can go fast with swimming, you can go slow, so it's definitely a great sport. I for one actually do swim sometimes. I need to get back into it. I haven't done it for a while, but I do find, like, when I'm in the water, it's extremely calming. And yeah, I really like it. I feel very safe within the water as well. So thank you for, sharing your hobbies and touching on swimming. Now, moving on for another icebreaker question. So when you were younger, what did you want to be when you grew up?
I had no clue what I wanted. Well, when I was very young, I wanted to be an optometrist for reasons that don't really, that are just very personal. We had a family friend who was an optometrist, and I thought he had a very cool office. And he did, in fact, have a very cool office. It was sort of a mid-century modern setting in a downtown area of a small town in Appalachia in the U.S. And so I guess that was part of it. I had an uncle who was a lawyer, so once I got to know him and listen to him, and that made me want to go in that direction. But once I went to college, I went through so many careers. And so, unlike my brother, who was a physician, or my younger brother, who's an electrical engineer, who both sort of knew what they wanted to be from early on, for me, it's been a process. And if one were to look at my career, it's been, there's no straight path. It's been, I sort of began after I got my PhD thinking I would be teaching. And then after a stint at doing that, I chose to go to Washington, D.C., which I found to be, and still do, a very exciting place because of the political environment. And because of my training, I was able to parlay the technical aspects of my training into jobs that involved more and more the policy-making components. And I really was very focused on how can we get policymakers to make decisions on the basis of facts and knowledge and data more. And so that experience of working for the Congress and ultimately in the Congress on the side of the House, helping to develop as a staffer, as a counsel to one of the committee chairs, was tremendous and eye-opening as to how policy is made and how laws are made. And following that, working for a range of research organizations and in the last eight, nine years, looking for ways to work in the healthcare community to advance the use of IT in companies in ways that would benefit patients and ultimately achieve the triple aim of more access and better access to care at a lower cost and at a higher quality.
Thank you. And further touching on your career, is there any advice that you can give for those looking to work in your current field?
Sure. I think that there's so many opportunities that are available to work in healthcare. Keep your eyes open and your options open. There are so many avenues into healthcare. I've seen people go into healthcare, and I'm not talking about clinical practice here, but in the other ways of helping advance a better health, the triple aim that I talked about: better quality, at a lower cost, and to more people. I've seen people go into healthcare who are attorneys, people who have an MBA, people who approach it from nursing. There are so many different avenues in. I think the common feature is enthusiasm. And if you get knocked down, pick yourself up, dust yourself off, and consider, do I want to keep going this path or do I want to try a different path? I think persistence and grit and a certain degree of not taking yourself too seriously has helped the people, the very smart people that I've known and worked with over the years, advance not only themselves in their careers, but the companies that they work for and the topics and issues that they work on.
That's great advice. Thank you, Jason. And I think that probably just about wraps us up. So thank you again, Jason, for joining our show. It was certainly explorative learning more about digital health as a topic. And it's certainly a topic that's really growing in conversation, especially in recent times. For those who would like to keep up to date with what you do or would like to get in touch with you, is there any way they can reach you?
I would really encourage people to look me up on LinkedIn, Jason Lee, middle initial is S. I work at the Open Group, of course, and that'd be a great way to contact me.
Great. Thank you again, Justin. Thanks for your time and thanks for coming on. Hopefully we can get you on again soon.
Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.